Russell Blaylock, who is in a former life was a neurosurgeon, but now is retired, and we're so grateful for that because he's a champion, he's an advocate, he's a voracious reader of the literature, and he completely understands natural health and the principles, and he's using this focus, this orientation, to help us identify and really develop a basis for some of the sound principles. And we're going to talk today about a subject that's near and dear to almost everyone's heart, which is swine flu. And I don't know of anyone who's done more compelling research to bring light and truth to this area of massive confusion and deception, especially through the media and what the government is doing. So welcome, Dr. Blaylock.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate it.
I'm just so delighted to have you here. So the biggest issue, I think, is there's so many different areas we can start, but why don't we start about the addressing some of the panic and the fear mongering that's going on, because the government is really seeking, and in some states, as we'll discuss in a bit, has sought to implement mandatory vaccination, and there's literally going to be probably well over 200 million doses of vaccine that are coming out with tens of billions of dollars in profit. So there's a huge economic incentive to scare people, to provide fear into their lives, that we are really looking at a very serious, potentially devastating epidemic. And just recently, the White House said that 50% of the public is projected to come down with this. So why don't we, before we go there, I think we need to establish some facts, some basis of scientific foundational understanding that's going to really highlight what we're really dealing with here and really give people a sense of reassurance that this is not a significant issue. So why don't we start there?
Well, yeah, I think that's a very good introduction. And what we've seen here is that we have two opposing forces. One, we have the people who are virologists, epidemiologists, medical experts on one side. Then we have FEMA, Homeland Security, and the government on the other side, in conjunction with the pharmaceutical companies that are the vaccine manufacturers. And we're getting two different stories. On one side, we're getting a lot of panic talk. They're using statistics like 50% of the American population, 150 million people will become infected, 1.8 million will end up in the hospital, and 300,000 will need ICU care. So they're painting a very scary picture on one side, but when we talk to medical experts, virologists, epidemiologists, we get a completely different story. Now, most of the data that I used to analyze this came from the official source, that is the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. And what they're saying is that, in fact, this is a rather mild seasonal flu. In other words, it's not as damaging to people as the previous seasonal flu. That's a completely different story. We're also seeing that the death rate from this flu actually is lower than the two previous seasons of flu, even in the pediatric age group, which has a lot of parents in a state of panic. So the CDC itself admits that, in fact, this is a rather mild infection. So in summary, what they're seeing is that this is not a particularly pathogenic or harmful virus, and it doesn't seem to be as harmful as the previous flu virus. It also appears to have a lower communicability, that is spreading through the community, than we see with previous flu viruses. So this figure that the government is now putting out, expecting 50% of the population to be infected, that means it would be more than twice, almost 2.5 times higher than the 1917-18 swine flu, which only affected 20% of the population. So their figures are highly, highly inflated. So we have a lower pathogenicity, a lower transmissibility of this virus than is being reported by the government. And when they looked at pediatric deaths, for instance, they found out, in fact, the number of children who died is smaller than in the previous two seasonal flus, which were not considered to be particularly harmful. They also looked at hospitalizations and found out, in fact, for all age groups, the hospitalization rate is either far below or no higher than the previous two seasons of flu. So your main concern, that is hospitalizations and death, are no different than previous flus, or less severe than previous flu seasons.
Well, let's go into another issue, because this has been bantered around for some time now, and I think initially, well, certainly when the first swine flu virus came out in the 70s, mid-70s, and then more recently with the bird flu hoax, which I actually wrote a book on, and now again, this reference back to the 1918 pandemic that's allegedly killed millions of people. Now, millions of people died in this time from some infection, but there's a big fallacy about this, and why don't you go into some of the details, because you've looked at this more carefully.
Well, what you have to realize is that this 1917-18 flu took place during the very end of World War I. There's extensive destruction, malnutrition, starvation, disruption of public health services all over Europe. Our troops were concentrated on troop carriers and troop ships and packed in concentration, and that's where all of this started. These troops were poorly nutritious because of the stress of battle, and so they were in a position where they were highly susceptible to any flu. Once they got the flu, then they transmitted it to the general public. Now, if you look at the health statistics, they say most of the people who died worldwide died of pneumonia, not from the flu virus itself. So there's evidence that, in fact, the flu virus of 1917-18 was not particularly pathogenic in terms of flu viruses. What we had at the time was very few antibiotics. All we had was some sulfanilamide antibiotics. We didn't have penicillin. We didn't have a lot that you could do once a person developed pneumonia. So if a person was went to the hospital, all they could do is give them food and a warm bed and an aspirin, because they didn't even have IV fluids or ventilators or respirators, etc. So there wasn't a lot you could do for a person. And what you have to realize, that most of the people that are hospitalized today are not hospitalized in intensive care unit. They're hospitalized for dehydration. So they give them an IV fluid, they rest a few days, they go back home. They're not that seriously ill. It's just that because of the GI effects of this virus, they haven't been able to drink like they were supposed to. So they're just in for hydration, not intensive care treatment.
But if they didn't have the hydration, most likely they'd wind up in the intensive care unit, which didn't exist in 1918.
That's exactly right.
So it's, you know, there's another misconception. And then the other issue is that this is in 1918, virology wasn't an advanced science. And I believe they didn't even identify the virus back then. It was a retrospective discovery. Is that correct?
That's correct. At the time, they had no idea what this was. They didn't know whether it was bacteria. Some even thought it was the plague. They didn't have a way to isolate viruses. They had no way to identify viruses. So it was not even identified as a virus at the time. This was done long after the epidemic was over. And what they did is they found three different people, two soldiers who they exhumed their bodies and examined their lung tissue and found fragments of a virus, and a person who was frozen in the permafrost in Alaska. They took lung tissue from it and typed the virus, and because it was in such bad condition, they concluded that it was H1N1 virus. So we didn't really have strong evidence of the nature of this virus in the first place.
Now, I think that's really a good preface, and thank you for giving it this foundation. One of the burning questions on everyone's, not a question, but a concern, is the issue of mandatory vaccinations in the fall. I mean, obviously, it could not have been done sooner because they just weren't able to scale up the infrastructure to produce these vaccines. But in a very short time, literally in a matter of weeks, there's going to be tens of millions of these vaccines that are available. And many people are going to be set in situations, even though they philosophically are opposed to these vaccines, and from their understanding, they want to avoid them. They are going to be forced through either their professional circumstances as a healthcare worker or living in a state like Massachusetts is going to mandate these. So many people, so that's the burning concern. And there are a number of media sources that are based in traditional conventional medicine that are highly skeptical and calling our concerns quackery. And I'm wondering, I don't know of anyone personally who's more carefully and thoroughly researched this issue than you. So I'm wondering if you can enlighten us on some of the scientific findings you've been able to come up with to really have a rebuttal against these types of accusations of quackery and again about the foundations of our concerns for these vaccines.
Well, I think all of this is based on hard science. All the material I get is from the scientific literature, the best of the scientific literature. So the science is saying this is a much ado about nothing so far. Now, this idea that, well, our only protection is the vaccine, the science also says very clearly, number one, there's strong, strong evidence from 51 different well-conducted studies that children under age 2 get absolutely no protection from the flu vaccine whatsoever. They did a 30-year study on the flu vaccine in adults and found out that it did not reduce hospitalizations or death at all, 0%. Now, these are the two reasons why people are told and frightened into getting this vaccine, to prevent hospitalization, to prevent death. Yet this 30-year, very intense study that was in one of our better peer-reviewed journals indicated there was no protection whatsoever. Now, that leads the question, why are they promoting this vaccine? If from all the other vaccines, flu season, we found there's virtually little or no protection whatsoever, but many of these vaccines are heavily contaminated. They're contaminated with pestivirus. They're contaminated with mycoplasma. They're contaminated with a number of stealth-type viruses, which the virologists in closed meetings, scientific meetings, discuss extensively. But they don't let the public know about it because they're afraid if the public knew that these vaccines were contaminated and could cause disease even 10, 20 years later, such as degenerative brain diseases and cancer, people would not be so quick to take these vaccines, particularly with these indications.
Well, I think that's the big issue. I think the common perception of the typical person in the public is that somehow there's this solution that's in this sterile vial that is this purified viral antigen that, if it's injected sterilely, is going to give them stimulate their immune system to prevent an infection and, again, give them immunity to it. But what they're unaware of are these infections that are these other viruses and contaminants that are just a byproduct an artifact of the actual production process of producing the vaccine. But I think even more importantly, this is what I'd like you to address, is that you cannot have these cultures in a virus in a bottle without becoming further contaminated and having a secondary growth going on. So that what they do is they put different types of materials that are essentially there to, you know, as preservatives to prevent other types of overgrowth. And then they put in what's called an adjuvant to improve the immune response. So why don't you address those? Because I think for many people, that is more of a serious concern than the actual virus that's in there.
Well, yeah, and to me, the contamination issue is far exceeds any other issue, because not only are you infected, but it's passed on to your children and your grandchildren. We saw this with the SV40 infection contamination of the polio virus. We're now seeing it in second and third generations, and it's producing brain tumors in these children and lung tumors. And ovarian tumors. So we're starting to isolate this very virus from the tumors that are occurring in our children and grandchildren. Well, this is being kept completely away from the public. It's widely discussed in the medical literature and the scientific literature. What most people don't know is there are literally hundreds of stealth-type viruses. That means viruses that are very, very difficult to isolate. Takes very intense methods to isolate. They're being associated with severe degenerative brain disease that can occur even a decade or two decades after you get the vaccination. Now, the neurological world has seen an absolute explosion of neurological diseases in the last 20 years. They do not know why it's occurring. We're seeing an explosion of asthma, We're seeing type 1 diabetes in children, juvenile diabetes. So we're seeing many vaccine-related disorders because of the vast number of vaccines being used. The other thing that concerns me is the powerful adjuvants that's being used. For instance, in this flu virus, they're considering using an adjuvant called squalene, which is an oil-based adjuvant. Well, all oil-based adjuvants are associated with autoimmune disease, particularly lupus, multiple sclerosis, and rheumatoid arthritis. In experimental animals, if you use this very same adjuvant called MF59 and ASO3, if you use that in animals, they develop these three conditions, particularly the lupus. Well, when you go to the scientific literature on autoimmune diseases, we see there's been an explosion of autoimmune diseases in, among the American public and the British, where the most concentrated vaccines programs are carried out. So we have some very major diseases, which our science is saying certainly has a strong connection to the number of vaccines and type of vaccines given. Now, this vaccine is being fast-tracked, which means they're not going to use the safety precautions they normally use, which are not very good in the first place. So it's going to be fast-tracked. They have a very low amount of antigen, in other words, the actual flu virus, to put in the vaccine. So they're massively increasing the adjuvant component. Now, I looked on the government site as to the type of studies that are being done because you're hearing, well, we're doing safety studies. All of the safety studies, they're doing five different studies. All the safety studies that are being done now do not contain any adjuvant whatsoever. Now, when the vaccine is released, it's going to have adjuvant in it. This is the same.
Gosh.
This is the very same bait and switch they did in 1976 that produced the disaster we saw. Over 500 people had Guillain-Barré, and that's just the reported cases. There was probably thousands, and we had at least 300 people died. Three elderly died in one vaccine site, and probably that was much higher because these were not by law reportable cases. So. This time, if they indeed use more powerful adjuvant, we're going to see a lot more Guillain-Barré paralysis. Infants are going to die. The pregnant women are going to have babies that have a high risk of developing autism and schizophrenia, which has been shown in the medical literature quite powerfully, that immunization during pregnancy, particularly repetitive, the way they're talking about here, can drastically increase the incidence and risk of autism and schizophrenia in the offspring, and plus the delayed neurological diseases. So all of these things are considerations when you realize that, number one, the vaccine is not effective. They don't even have any hope that it will be effective. Plus, it has all of these serious consequences, the contamination and the autoimmune response to this vaccine, as well as the smoldering delayed brain degeneration. And these things are just not being discussed with the public. The public has the view, well, if the government says it's okay, it must be okay, and the regulatory agencies check it for safety, and I don't want to die from the flu. Now, as I analyze this data, what I found out, the death rate from the flu so far is far less than 1%. Even in the 1917-18 flu, the death rate reached only 3%. Well, the government is trying to imply that the death rate will be even higher than that. We're talking about 10 or 20% death rate from government statistics, which is not based on any science whatsoever. The scientific world, even the CDC, totally disagrees with the figures that the government's putting out.
Well, there might be some science. There's the science of justification for implementing the system, which is going to generate massive profits for the drug companies.
Yeah, drug companies will make a virtual killing off of this. I mean, you're talking about they're preparing at least 4 billion doses of this vaccine worldwide. So they're going to make an absolute killing. And the Novartis company, which is the primary supplier of the vaccine, said nobody will get it for free. So they don't plan to give it out at all. It's going to be sold to whoever gets used to it.
They're using the leverage of the government to essentially confiscate this income.
That's right. And when you look at these studies, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's head of the Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, who's head of this whole study program, they asked him the question, do you have any experience in using these adjuvants in children? He says, no, we don't have any data. So in other words, millions of children will be guinea pigs to see what these adjuvants will do. They asked him, well, do you know what will happen if you mix these viruses in these three different vaccines that you're planning to give? And he said, no, we don't have any idea. They could exchange their genetic structure and produce even more virulent viruses. So we don't really know. So there's a lot of unknowns that they admit. Then they ask, well, two of the big studies are being done by two major pharmaceutical companies, but the number one supplier of the vaccine, are you planning on looking at the data that they're collecting on safety? And his answer was no, they have their own very complicated internal examining system, and we'll just let them do it. In other words, it can do it in secrecy. And so they can come out and announce it's completely safe. Now, we have some precedent for that. There were, on the issue of safety of squalene, that oil-based adjuvant they put in the vaccine. I looked up the medical literature on it. There were three articles that were published saying that this was absolutely safe. One of the articles was published by the Novartis Pharmaceutical Company, the other one by Chiron Pharmaceutical Company, which actually made the adjuvant and now has been bought up by Novartis. And the third was by the Department of Defense. All the independent studies showed it produced high incidence of rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, and multiple sclerosis like disease. So what we see is the pharmaceutical companies are certainly not beyond faking studies. And if you're going to let the number one supplier do internal studies, safety studies, and then just announce to the public, oh, we found that it was completely safe, we're going to have a worse disaster than we had in 1976. The whole idea of force vaccinating people, destroying their lives, killing their children, ruining the offspring of pregnant women, and killing the elderly and producing a future generation of severe degenerative brain disorders and cancer, to me is one of the worst abominations you could ever think of by your state and federal governments.
Morally reprehensible. Now, one of the arguments that people use to suggest that the squalene isn't as dangerous as you just suggested it was they cite these studies, which they don't tell people were funded by the pharmaceutical companies, but they also say that it's been used in many products topically and there's no concern. So perhaps you can address the issue of the difference between the topical application of squalene and its use as an intravenous adjuvant.
Yeah, topically or orally.
Orally, right.
A lot of foods contain squalene, and you can eat it because of the digestive process and the way that it passes through the intestinal wall. It's safe. What's dangerous is when you inject it into the muscle. A lot of people don't understand that vaccination is the most abnormal way to produce immunity in a person. It does not replicate natural infection. You get a completely different immune reaction than you would normally, and this immune reaction can be very destructive, and it's a long-term reaction. It can go on for years, producing brain microglia cell activation, which produces a smoldering brain inflammation with a loss of memory, loss of coordination, language function. We can have some devastating effects from this smoldering brain inflammation that's being completely ignored by these people. Yet it's well demonstrated in the scientific literature. They just don't want to face it.
Now, the other concern, too, we talked about the squalene as an adjuvant, but there's also the issue of the preservatives, things like mercury. And it's my understanding that all of these new vaccines, these billions of doses that are being produced, will all have mercury as a preservative. Is that correct?
That's my understanding. Now, I saw one report that they're planning on not using it, but what they're saying about the seasonal flu, the one that they're planning on giving with the other two swine flu vaccine, will have mercury in it. Now, mercury, even in very low concentration, has been shown to produce activation of these immune cells in the brain, which can produce slow degeneration of the brain. The fact that you would be giving this to an infant or to a pregnant woman or to the elderly is terrifying, because this mercury accumulates in the brain. It is converted to ionic mercury, which is the most destructive and the most difficult to remove from the brain. So it stays there for decades, if not a lifetime. And even in those small concentrations can produce significant brain neurodegeneration. The other one is aluminum, is a major concern. Virtually all the vaccines contain aluminum. That is the only approved adjuvant in the United States at this point. Well, aluminum has been shown to accumulate in the brain from vaccines used in humans. And this aluminum stays there a lifetime. It produces brain inflammation. It is associated with Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, a lot of bad diseases. Now, just speaking about Lou Gehrig disease, which is about 100% fatal disease, we find that vaccination increases the incident of ALS in soldiers who were taking the anthrax vaccine some 200%. So we had a dramatic increase in ALS cases among military personnel that were forced to take the anthrax vaccine. Now, you also have to remember, in the children, not only will they be getting this flu vaccine, but their regular schedule of vaccine. Many of these vaccines are immune suppressing. MMR vaccines are powerful immune suppressant. So if they've taken their MMR vaccine and then they are exposed to the flu virus, it increases their risk of dying from the virus, where they normally wouldn't be. The HIB vaccine is also an immune suppressing vaccine. Parents generally are not told this, but they will tell them, if you take the HIB vaccine, they shouldn't be in daycare for about 2 weeks. That's because they have significant immune suppression for that length of time. The MMR is powerfully immune suppressing for several weeks. So, you know, if you're going to say there's an emergency with this flu, they should suspend all MMR and HIB vaccines during this period, because that makes these children a lot more susceptible.
Thank you for pointing that out. I just wanted to mention one point on the mercury too, just to get people a perspective and with respect to how toxic it is. Most poisons are toxic at parts per million, but mercury, my understanding is, it's toxic at parts per billion. And to give an understanding of that, that would be like one grain of salt in an entire swimming pool. So it doesn't take much to cause significant damage.
Well, when you're talking about the toxicity of mercury in the brain, we're talking about nanograms.
So parts per billion.
Yeah, that's millions of a gram. So yeah. You're talking about concentrations that are so small, they're almost at the range of detection. So when we talk about toxicity, we're not talking about like taking arsenic and you drop dead. What we're talking about is it causes an interference of cell function. Particularly in the brain, so that the synaptic connections are not properly wired. And you can have either subtle problems like language problems, learning problems, behavioral problems, all the way to full-blown autism. So we know that the dysfunction, the abnormal function of the brain caused by mercury, can be quite significant. We also know that mercury and aluminum toxicity interacts in the brain, so that they worsen each other's toxicity. Well, both are in a lot of these vaccines. And, you know, mothers are never counseled on this, because most doctors are not aware of these things. This is not something you're taught in medical school or your medical training. Most physicians get their information about vaccines from the vaccine manufacturers and from their societies. For instance, the American Academy of Pediatrics. Well, a number of investigations have shown that the people on the vaccine board, the American Academy of Pediatrics, a large percentage of them are receiving money from the vaccine manufacturers. So the physicians are not getting accurate information, and they're not looking and digging into this scientific literature the way I do to find out the truth about these vaccines and these adjuvants.
Well, we really appreciate all the work you've done. If we can just, if you could just comment on the specific characteristics of the people who are dying. These are not your normal healthy people who are just living a lifestyle. It's somehow someone sneezes on them with swine flu and they drop dead.
Well, the Centers for Disease Control actually did a study to see why the children were dying. What they found is 32% that died had asthma. They found that 2/3 that died had either seizures, cerebral palsy, or other neurological problems, which are also associated with immune suppression. So the vast majority, almost 90% of the children that die have serious neurological problems, serious medical problems, or asthma. Now, a study on asthma and vaccine showed that vaccinating children with asthma with the flu vaccine did not prevent complications of asthma at all, had no effectiveness whatsoever. So they can't give the argument, well, the children with asthma need to be vaccinated because there's no protection. That's been proven. Now, with this infection and relation to disease, is also in adults, if you're diabetic, if you have heart disease, if you have any kind of immune deficiency, if you have poor nutrition, particularly for the nutrition that's necessary for immune function, it puts you at higher risk of dying. Now, the government recently put out this crazy statistic that they estimate 90,000 people might die from the flu. Well, I ran the numbers based on what we've seen so far, and actually the number's about 5,000. Now, if you look at the statistics on flu deaths every year, that's maybe 4 or 5 times higher than normal, but it can vary. Now, you remember, not every year, we always get this advertisement that 36,000 people
right.
die.
A classic statistic, right.
It's not true, because if you go to the Center for Disease Control website, you find out, well, actually about 1,200 to 800 people a year die from the flu. So at the worst projection of this flu, actually we would see maybe 5,200 deaths, not 90,000 like the fear mongers from the government are trying to tell people. It's just not true.
Oh, so basically, if anyone listening or watching this information, it needs to be reassured that if they essentially don't have any chronic degenerative disease and are leading a healthy lifestyle, and almost everyone watching this understands what that is, their risk of suffering any significant complication is virtually non-existent, and that their primary concern, their most significant legitimate issue, is to have the government impose and mandate a mandatory vaccination. So some of the people will be exposed to that. That's just inevitable because of the laws that have already been passed in a few states. So I'm wondering if you could comment on some of the strategies that people could adopt if they are, for whatever reason, put in those circumstances that they are forced to get this vaccine.
Well, there's several things you can do to prevent some of the vaccine reaction. This is true with any kind of vaccine. It's number one is you want to reduce the immune reaction at the site of injection. You can do that by putting a cold compress at the site of injection as quickly as possible. And you continue that for several days until the immune reaction calms down. That'll prevent a lot of this hyper immune reaction that causes fever, and listlessness, feeling really bad, tired, fatigue, those kind of symptoms.
That's really profound. It's really quite shocking to find out that something so very simple and virtually inexpensive, the only cost to that is really the time to put an ice pack on it. And you're suggesting that simple intervention can have a dramatic reduction in the side effects that people experience.
Oh, absolutely. And I've witnessed this before when I was in pediatric neurosurgery. Kids getting vaccinated, and they'd be screaming and screaming and screaming and fever, and we put a cold pack on their injection site, and it would just all stop.
That's,
and they would be fine.
It's almost magical.
It is. And what you're trying to do is prevent the systemic activation of the brain's immune cells. And that's the way you do it. You block the systemic immune reaction. That blocks the brain's immune reaction, and that's highly protective of the brain, particularly in children. There's quite a few supplements like curcumin and quercetin, which you mix with olive oil for absorption, which dramatically reduces inflammation in the body. The people that are dying of this are dying from what we call a cytokine storm, and what that means is their immune system is not functioning properly. So they can't get rid of the virus, and their immune system keeps trying and pouring out all these toxic cytokines. That produces intense inflammation in the lungs and the other body organs. Curcumin, quercetin, DHA type oil from the omega-3 oils, vitamin D3 in particular, very, very potent in reducing that cytokine storm and reducing excess immune overreaction. The best protection you have is a high intake of vitamin D3, and that's include babies, children, women, old people. Everybody will be protected. Now, it takes a high dose. All children, even small children, 2,000 units of vitamin D3 is highly protected. In adults, 5,000 to 10,000 units a day. This is perfectly safe. And what they've shown is that when you do this, not only does it modulate the immune reaction so it doesn't overreact, it also makes your body produce what's called antimicrobial peptides, which are directly will kill viruses, bacteria, and fungi. And we know that the mortality of flu and other type viruses is directly proportional to your vitamin D3 level. So that's the greatest protection you could do, is just start right now on your vitamin D3. That, you know, children should take 2,000, adults at least 5,000 international units a day under the guidance of their physician. And if they do that, their protection and risk of dying will be dramatically less. Yeah, multivitamin will boost most elderly people's immunity, so it returns to normal. You know, there's such a thing as called age-related immune suppression. That's found to be almost purely nutritional. If you take a multivitamin mineral, particularly with selenium in it, your vitamin E, your vitamin C, and your vitamin D3, your risk of dying from the flu is infinitesimally small. We're talking about less than 1%, less than 1/100th of a percent if you use these simple measures.
Well, thank you for a really concise summary of what people can do. And I would agree with almost all of it, except for one point about the vitamin D3 and using that under the guidance of your physician, because most physicians are relatively ignorant about this and will tell people misinformation and not give them the right. Now, there's some certainly educated and enlightened physicians who will understand it, but you know, I think it is wise, and I think your doses you recommended are right on target. But the experience is that there's not really a magical dose. There's a pretty wide variation of what people need, and the only way to know for sure is to actually measure your blood level. So ideally, that's the best combination, and then you know what the right dose is, because we're approaching winter, and that's another variable. That's one of the reasons why the mortality and the morbidity increases, because in winter, we don't get exposure to the sunshine. Our vitamin D levels almost universally drop, and people have only been sensitized to the importance of vitamin D just recently. So,
well, the new studies are showing that virtually all of the population in the United States is vitamin D3 deficient, and they have directly correlated your risk of dying from an infection being correlated with your blood level of vitamin D3, the functional form.
Yeah.
And so if you increase it, your risk of dying from these infections is infinitesimally small, and your risk of developing an autoimmune disease or severe brain disease from it also falls significantly. So that's your number one protection right there.
Just watching this interview, I'm sure people are going to be just enormously impressed with your ability to sort through the data and provide them with practical, simple measures that have dramatic influence on their health, and not only for themselves, but their family. So if people want to access your information, how could they find more of what you're doing, and what would the best way to do that?
Well, they can go to my website, which is RussellBlaylockMD.com. Has some information there. They can download. They're free to use it. So I would recommend they go to the website and look through that material.
Okay, great. You've got a newsletter, too. Has information for your newsletter up there?
Yes, you can get the newsletter through there. But I've written a lot in my newsletters about vaccines, dangers of vaccines, what they do, why they're harmful. And some of the lies we're told about things like herd immunity and these sort of things.
Well, again, I can't thank you enough. You're a major inspiration. I'm just incredibly grateful for all the wonderful information you're compiling and sharing and educating us about what the truth really is, because it's a bit of a challenge to sort through this data, especially when we've got media and the government telling us one thing that's heavily biased and influenced by a multinational, multi-billion-dollar corporations are going to make tens of billions of dollars from this deception and this fraud that is being perpetrated upon us. So thanks again. Thanks for everything you're doing.
Well, I thank you for allowing me to share this information.